Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm joined now by the writer Nuala O'Connor. Welcome, Nuala.
Thanks a million, Brendan.
So, Nuala, people might remember your last novel, Nora, was a huge success. And your new book, Seaborn, is your imagining of the life of the Irish pirate Anne Bonny. So Nora Barnacle, you've also done Emily Dickinson. Is there a kind of a pattern here of reclaiming misunderstood women from history?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm drawn to mavericks, but also I want to sort of undo a lot of the myths that have been swirling around these women. A lot of them have been smudged by history, told in ways that maybe were more male-gazy. So I'm bringing the female gaze to these women and bringing them back into the centre, away from the men who control their lives, and telling their stories with them with perfect agency, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And a myth can be a one-line kind of simple idea as well about people, can't it? When you're humanising them. Do you identify with them?
I do, really. I suppose I've had a lot of ups and downs in life since I sort of emerged from my very Catholic childhood around the age of 18 and started really to think for myself, I guess. My father was, yeah, I suppose he was quite the patriarch, but he was also sort of super Catholic. And so we lived in a very loving environment, but it was also, we were sheltered, I would say. And then I went to college and I also grew up in a non-drinking household. I went to college and I kind of went nuts. I started drinking and
actually, we all knew those people in college who came from those very sheltered environments. They went crazy when they got
absolutely
away from home.
Absolutely, yeah. Bananas, you know. And I suppose I was a shy introvert and alcohol was a way for me to megaphone, I suppose, and to feel gregarious when I didn't feel that way at all. So it helped me with shyness and introversion. But of course, it wasn't helping me at all. But it took me a long time to figure that out.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people, a lot of Irish people, that's kind of why they drink, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we are kind of, even though we love talking and storytelling and all that, I think we are a kind of a shy nation. We're very much alarmed by American over-the-topness and positivity when we encounter it because we're more inclined to be self-effacing and more quiet, I suppose.
Yeah. No, it's a bit more complicated than that for you because you found out, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
That you are autistic?
Yes, yeah. And I heard a woman, a late diagnosed woman, talking on the radio about her late diagnosis. And I had been struggling for a long time with mental health issues, deep depressions, a lot of social anxiety, a lot of failed friendships. And I knew I was masking a lot. Like, I self-identified, if you want to say, as a, you know, quiet, hermity introvert, a very sensitive person. And then when I heard the description of autism and how it presents in women, because naturally the world has seen autism as a male issue for so long, I was ticking off everything she was saying, you know, just like a phone conversation, struggle around friendship, you know, not liking glassy light in supermarkets. Just so many of the things she was saying, I was like, oh my God, that's me, that's me. Difficulty in social situations, always wanting to go home, always sort of pretending to be a very calm, serene person when in my head it was like there was a circus in there. And people often said to me, you're so serene and you're so comfortable in your own skin. And I would just be laughing like, this is, I am not. I seriously am not.
You seem really calm now and like at one with yourself.
No, my heart is leathering in my chest. No, I mean, I think that there are things that I can do, like, and articulacy actually is a very female autistic trait. You know, a lot of autistic girls are actually hyperlexic. They learn to read very early. They're very good with words. Often one of their special interests is words. And that's how it was for me. I learned to read at 3. I've always been a huge reader. I was brought up bilingually, all school and college through Irish. We spoke English at home. And so this whole thing of language is like where I'm most comfortable and happiest. It's like my playground. I love writing. You know, it's kind of, I had chosen a very autistic life for myself and set my life up in a very autism friendly way without really knowing that that's what I was doing.
Did it ever cross your mind?
Yes, I'd have to say my siblings and myself used to have conversations about it in our teens and 20s, and we would sort of accuse each other. That sounds like a horrible word, but we would say you're so spectrum-y, you know, because we recognise that our sort of loner tendencies, our creativity, our difficulties around interacting socially were autistic traits. We recognised that. And my mother used to say to me when I was a child, I think there's something wrong with your brain. But she never got me checked out. You know, it just, I don't think people believed girls were autistic. I'm 54. They didn't believe there was autistic girls when I was young. So there wasn't really a hope in me getting a diagnosis as such.
Is it a relief?
Huge relief. Yeah, I feel like, well, two things, right? I gave up alcohol when I was 50 because I realised it wasn't helping my anxiety. It was actually making it worse. And then when I gave up alcohol, I thought, oh, it's going to be miraculous now. Everything's going to fall into place. Not realising that that's where the work was to begin of the deep dive. And you do have to do a lot of the work yourself and start eliminating. So I went to counselling. I went to my GP and brilliantly, she put me on anti-anxiety meds, which have helped hugely as well. But it wasn't until I heard the woman on the radio that I realised there is this extra part. There is this extra part why I just seem to struggle endlessly and talk about my struggle endlessly to my beloved husband, who has the patience of 10 saints. And he has been my rock through this. Really, his hand has been to my back and he's helped me through it and understand. So, yeah, the diagnosis, huge relief.
And does it make sense of everything then when you look
back? Absolutely. I'm looking back even at essays I've written in the last few years through now this autistic lens and understanding why I struggled so much with various things. And it makes sense of my whole life. So initially I was euphoric. I had an answer at last to why my trot through life is so difficult. And then the euphoria wears off and it's like, oh, OK, that means I'm stuck like this. Because autism is never going to be gone away. It's not something that you can fix and nor should you want to. You know, so I had this vision of myself that I would finally get to be the calm, serene, welcoming people to my home woman of my dreams. I had this sort of vision of myself, like literally a vision. Yeah. I see things very visually. And then I had to accept I'm literally never going to be that. That's never going to be me. I'm always going to have this struggle for balance where I'm trying to find a way to live whereby I can do the things I love, like travelling and doing public events around my writing, but that I have to take a lot of time to calm down and spend time on my own, which is very nurturing for me. And I have been quite good at that because I also have ADHD, which is sort of the novelty loving aspect of things, but I'm also quite autistic and rigid about time. And so I get my writing done every day because I know it's better for me to be writing than not writing. I have my walk at a certain time every day. I eat my lunch, the same lunch every day, you know, so I have all these rigid aspects. But then I feel blessed as well to have the ADHD thing about novelty and trying new things. So I'm not hugely static. I'm okay. always learning. I think ADHD is a love and a joy in learning new things. And I think that's a very positive thing in my life because I love research and I love deep dives into subjects.
Yeah. So it's not a bad old combo with the two. It works for you. I'm thinking of the other you who's, you know, welcoming people into her home and gregarious and laughing with a highball in your hand and all that kind of thing. Were you like a self-improver putting yourself under fierce pressure all those years I should be like other people? Like?
Totally, yeah. Always watching other people and trying to figure out how they do everything and a very sort of observant of friendships, you know, very envious of people who seem to have really deep and good friendships that they were able to sustain. I have traditionally been able to make friends. I just haven't been able to keep them.
Okay.
Because I have a habit of being maybe overly intense at the start, sort of bombarding my friendship object or my love object, and then having to take an assessment period, whereby I kind of disappear. And then the person is completely confused. They don't know if I like them or don't like them or whatever. I can't think for other people, obviously, but I will come back if people can be patient. Like, I don't like talking on the phone. I don't like seeing people a lot. So if you like sporadic meetups, one-on-one and deep conversation, I'm here for that. I'm not here for talking on the phone to people every day or meeting up a lot or going to noisy pubs and stuff like that. But I have a few friends who fulfill this, and actually, no coincidence maybe that most of my friends live abroad and most of them are older than me and they're creatives as well. So they're the people I can spill my heart to.
And is that enough?
Is it?
Are they fulfilling for, or is it lonely?
It can be very lonely. I have been very lonely. And actually, the lack of deep friendships really upset me. About 2 years ago, I was really down a deep well of depression and I was very upset about the lack of friends. I would cry nearly daily about it. But finding out that I was autistic made me reframe and look and learn, and that having a few close people in your life is enough. I have sisters that I can talk to.
And they get you, yeah?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. We'd be very similar, shall we say.
Okay.
And, you know, having my husband who's fantastic. And
he gets you.
He gets me completely.
Yeah. You need the people who get you, don't
you?
You
do. And I
come here. So hang on, just a question about him then. So the friendships, you weren't good at that. Are you better at relationships?
Yeah. I mean, I think Finbar can take my intensity maybe in a way that other people can't. Like, for years, I would say to him, oh, I'm just too much for people. And I can be, but he calls it passion. He's the most positive person I know. Everything, he's the glass half full and I'm the glass half empty. He's like the water to my fire, really. But he sees everything. Like, I do accuse him of being Pollyanna. And I do say about his family, who are fabulous, lovely people, that they're like hamsters and I'm like a hedgehog in among them. And my family, we're all like hedgehogs bashing up against each other. So his family have this lovely, soft, very sharing and caring sort of way. And me and my family sort of are like a line of hedgehogs walking along beside each other, trying not to knock off each other.
Yeah, that I get that picture, yeah. How was his reaction to the diagnosis?
Sure, he's delighted.
Yeah.
Delighted for me to get an answer, but also I'm much easier to live with. Because having this understanding has made me much more self-forgiving, more self-compassionate. I'm still learning that. I'm learning acceptance. I'm not brilliant at acceptance in general, but I'm learning to accept that my autistic traits are inherent. I don't have a broken neurotypical brain. I just have a neurodivergent brain. It steers me. Sometimes it steers me into overwhelm. And now I'm learning to retreat is not a bad thing. Self-care is not a bad thing. It's actually a gift to yourself and those around you. Because if I can take care of me, then I can take care of my family. And yeah, he's delighted. And he has noticed that my happiness levels have just soared compared to where I was. You know, I would take everything very personally. You know, any difficult things, I would feel very personally attacked by them, rather than being a bit more rational about them. So I'm just learning, really. And I do that by doing courses. I did a course with Thriving Autistic, for example, which is specifically geared at late diagnosed adults. And that was brilliant because they're giving you, you know, they're telling you the podcasts to listen to, and they're telling you, here's tricks and tips about how to manage overwhelm and meltdowns and all of these things that go with being autistic. So it's having resources, because I found ordinary therapy wasn't helping me, CBT wasn't helping me, and apparently they don't really help autistic minds. But there are other things you can do. I just think, also because research is constantly evolving, expanding in the world of autism, there's a lot to learn. And we love learning, so it's ideal.
Yeah, so I can see you're becoming an expert now. And Camir, can you, stop me at any, I will rely on you to say, no, look, stop, you're being too nosy, but can we just continue this thread for a minute? So I expect you have now looked into it very well and everything. What's your understanding of autism and what it is, or is that a ridiculous question?
I think it is.
Do you know what I mean?
Genetically driven, and that it definitely runs in families, and that it is neurons in the brain firing in a certain way. But it seems to present differently in males and females. And so we have this traditional view of autistic people, mainly boys, as being maybe non-speaking, but also, I think we also have a very narrow view of it, that it's always coupled with learning disabilities, and it isn't always. So girls tend to present quite differently. We tend to more act in when we're out in the world. So we're full of a lot of holding things in, self-blame, trying to fit in. And then maybe we act out at home. So meltdowns, okay. Shutdowns. So my mother used to call me a Lutheran virago. That was what she called me. Because I would come home and I would sort of explode, slamming doors, screaming, cursing. My neighbour called me the little cursor. Like, I was a bit of a tyrant of a child. But I knew I wasn't willfully being awkward or having tantrums. I knew I wasn't. It just seemed like something would go off inside me and I couldn't control this sort of flare-up of anxiety, this spillover. Other ways that it probably presents in girls is through blurting. There's an honesty to autistic people that we tend to say what we mean and we don't cope well with maybe the subtleties in conversations and the kind lies. We're not fully alert to them, which is also a problem in the sense that you can end up being bullied at school and work a lot.
Because you don't go along with the same rules, the kind of unwritten rules that everybody else.
Exactly.
Kind of has,
sort of this sort of fake politeness that autistic people don't really understand hugely. It's like if you say something, we think you mean it, and then maybe you don't. Maybe you'll say, oh, sure, look, we'll catch up for coffee next week, and you've no intention of catching up. But I've taken it very literally that we're catching up. Okay. Do you know what I mean? Other things is, excuse me, perfectionism. A tendency towards trying to control everything in your environment and in your schoolwork. So I would have been, another of my mother's monikers for me was, what is it, House Devil, Street Angel, or the other way around? I was the perfect student at school. I was quiet, obedient, everything was done on time, everything was neat.
Okay.
And then I'd come home and I'd be the Lutheran virago. And it was like almost a shock for my mother to go into the school and hear how much they loved Nuala and how great she was. And at home I was like, I was a devil, like I was just always given out.
Because in school, like the structure and the rules, you got that. You
I loved
that,
that but I also wanted to be the best. I wanted to be good in the eyes of those in authority, the teachers. And I liked my teachers and I loved learning. So it's a good structured environment for me. And then at home, I just would kick off, you know, I couldn't kind of cope. I was a family of seven. We lived in a small house initially and then moved to a bigger one, but always bumping up against people, a lot of sensory overload with people. And of course, my brothers would sit on me and bash me up and, you know, this sort of stuff. So,
come here, you must have been exhausted by the time you hit 50 or whenever you started kind of realising what was up.
Yeah, I was at a very low ebb and I had just done 2 years of promotion for Nora, my novel, and perfectionism makes you take on too much. You know, you overload your plate because at a distance it looks manageable. And then at the time, like, it's too much. I was travelling a lot abroad and travelling here in Ireland and doing events and all sorts of things. And I got completely burnt out. And really, my sister said she saw me that October and she said I was practically unrecognisable. I was almost shut down. And a few days later, after she'd seen me, I went to Berlin for a work trip and I basically spent the whole time in bed. I got up to do the event and went back to bed. I just had reached a point of exhaustion whereby I was dragging myself through the world. And it was at that point that, my GP and my husband really stepped in and made me go. I did grow up in a house where you weren't really allowed to be sick. So that's an ableist notion. We know now, but I think you bring that internalized ableism forward with you. And so I wouldn't have thought drugs were a good thing. I wouldn't have thought going to the doctor a lot was a good thing. I had this very sort of you have to just battle on mentality.
Yeah.
But now I would say to anyone, if you are struggling mentally, drugs can give you space to do the other work that you might need to do, finding out what's the best way for yourself to be in the world. So, you know, antidepressants, I used to be embarrassed about the fact that I might need them and so I wouldn't go on them. And now I'm just delighted. I'm a total convert, you know. If you feel you need medication, or if you feel that alcohol is stepping in the way of your best life, maybe listen to those voices and investigate and try and make a life. Like, I have to say, last year was one of the happiest years of my life. I had a lot of balance, a lot of, well, not a lot of anti-anxiety medication, but I was taking it. And I just felt so calm and happy. And you begin to glow. Like, I was out of hope 2 years ago. And hope is something I believe in. And I know it was still in there. It was still sort of burning away inside me, but the flame was very, very dull. I mean, it really was. All I wanted to do was sleep, and I didn't see the point in anything. So to actually come back from that, which I thought was impossible, I thought, I know other people say there's hope, but I don't actually believe it. And then to find that there is, and that there's actual joy as well, has been stunning. It has been such a brilliant journey for me. The combination of alcohol out, autism diagnosis in, and then actually the Arts Council as well had given me a commission to write my novel Zeborn, which means they gave me money, basically. They gave my publisher money to commission me to write it. And that made a difference, because I could step off the treadmill last year and just be at home writing and finishing editing that book and stuff. So all of those things combined brought me a really great and happy year. And I'd urge anyone who thinks they're overworking, you probably are. And it's a good idea just to roll back a bit and take a big picture look at it and see what can go. You know, what can... I've learned how to say no, for example, which is something wasn't in my vocabulary as a people-pleasing perfectionist, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's so important, especially for women, as we tend to have an overloaded plate. Like, I've outsourced a lot of the home stuff to my husband, and he's very willing to do it. So he makes all the dinners now, does all the school runs, because they were just taking up too much of my bandwidth. Autism and ADHD together, which is called ADHD, can use up a lot of your energy. And so you have to conserve energy for the things that you actually need and want to do. And for me, that's writing and, you know, other things around. I'm in a couple of groups where I live in East Galway, you know, making sure I can get to my groups and different things like that that keep me a little bit social, but not too much.
Okay. It's interesting you say there, the thing about the Arts Council giving you the money enabled you to write the book. Is there not a great living in, like, you would be, you're celebrated, fated, like, you know, Nora was, it was one book, one city, wasn't it? And one city, one book. And, you know, you would be regarded as a writer who was thriving and doing well and all that. Not a great living, no?
No, I mean, advances are small. In Ireland, we're a small country. My other books were published in the States. This one hasn't been. You'd get more money probably from the States in advances, but... we only have small publishers in Ireland, and any of the bigger publishers that are here are sort of offshoots of the companies in the UK. So there tends not to be a lot of money up front for writers. And then it's difficult to make money off a book that retails for €17 and you get about €1 for each copy sold. Like, as you know, a bestseller in Ireland in a week is maybe 400, 500 copies, something like that.
Yeah.
And that lasts for a couple of weeks, and then the next book takes that slot, you know. So no, there's not a lot of money.
You've put 2 years potentially into it or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at least. Yeah.
Come here. An interesting thing. Given all you've just told me there now, right? The Seaborn... Anne Bonny and the other characters, they're so rich, they're so full of life. You've such an understanding of people and their interior worlds and everything. Because one trope we might have about autism is that, you know, you don't get people, or there's no empathy or whatever. But clearly, you do understand human beings very well, because the characters are... I mean, they jump off the page.
I think it's a myth about this thing about autism and empathy. Well, especially autistic women are very empathic, but also we're detail lovers. And so we will dive into the weeds of how human beings operate. We're always watching ye to try and figure out what you're up to so that we can copy and maybe reenact what we see, you know. So I think we're very interested in things like psychology and anthropology and things like that. And I always would have been. I remember we had this wonderful encyclopedia that my parents bought. It was a parts one called The Family of Man. And I used to study that and study it. You know, it was all about people from all over the world. And I think that, you know, when you're a writer, you're already someone who is a keen observer of how humans act and interact. Like, if we go to a party or anything, I'd say afterwards to Finbar, did you hear what she said? Oh, my God, I knew what she meant by that. And he'd be, he wouldn't have heard it at all. He just wouldn't. Those kind of details would go over his head, whereas I'm interested in all of the tiny details. So I think it's a detail issue.
Yeah. And you can see as well, like you brought me to, there's Nassau in the Bahamas. Like, yeah. I'm there. I'm in the Carolinas. I'm in Kinsale 200 years ago. Like, you, very lightly, you conjured the texture of the places so well as well. So you obviously went deep on figuring out what they'd be like as well.
Oh, huge as well. I'm very interested in material culture. I like things. So I'm always interested in what did people eat? What did they wear? How did they get dressed? You know, going through all that stuff about clothing. And thankfully, there's wonderful books written about all of that and great sites. And like the Caribbean have very good online record systems, so you can look through records and stuff. And, you know, a lot of the public libraries in America have a lot of good stuff online as well. So there's a lot of great research available at your fingertips.
You said there about the writing that, you know, you should write in the morning. It's good for you. Is the writing a kind of, I don't want to say safe space, like, but it's a good place for you, is it?
Totally. It's deeply linked into my mental health and my mental security, and my balance is to write every day in the morning, first thing, because I'm a morning person. I'm a much saner, happier person when I write. It's actually, you know, I'm very rigid, as I said, about time and about all of that, rigid about everything, what I eat, when things happen. But in writing, I do go into a flow state. It's where I'm free.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm free to invent. There's no structure. I'm not a planner when I write. I'm much more organic. I just let things happen. So that's my sort of free-flowing space, and I love it.
Cool. Come here. You're a very open person. Is that is it a reaction to growing up in the deeply Catholic household, or to growing up in the Ireland we all kind of grew up in back then?
I mean, that was the Ireland of our youth. Yes, I am. And I sometimes think I alarm my family. And people often say to me, you're very honest, as if it's not quite the right thing. But as a reader, I love honest reading, love memoirs, biographies, all of that. Not the really coy ones, but the really upfront and open ones. I read Fern Brady recently, the autistic comedian from Scotland. And, you know, she really reveals a lot about her life and her background, and just marvellous, just so interesting. What's the point in us being these secretive beings when if we talk about stuff, we can help other people? You know, I want other potentially autistic women maybe to hear or read me and think, gosh, that sounds like me, and look into it and maybe get some hope and joy and happiness from my story, because it means that they're not broken and they're not weird and they're not willfully awkward, that literally their brain is driving them.
Well, I've good news for you. They are. the text coming in. I feel as though this lady is speaking about my life. Thank you so much for your honesty. Putting a name on it is a major step towards acceptance. I'm hearing things about myself from what this woman is saying. Very thought-provoking interview. Please can I be Nuala's friend? She just described me to a T, from strict no alcohol upbringing, going mad at college, journey with anxiety and depression, to turning 50 and thinking, what is happening to me? That's from Adele. I think, like, you know, you were talking today kind of a lot about what we might call your difference. But actually, I think you were actually talking about humanity that a lot of people, typical and non-typical, are experiencing. Nuala, I was looking forward to this conversation, but can I say you have surpassed all expectations. That was just fabulous. I'm totes emotional after that. Seaborn is the book, and it's terrific. It's published by New Island Books. Nuala O'Connor, thank you so much, Nuala.
Thanks, Brendan.
Email brendan@rte.ie.